Well, we enter the high point of the four operas now, Siegfried, and we have the true hero, the victor, the one that is going to overcome, which is what his name really means. And this is probably, especially the last act, this is a three-act opera, and the last act is probably what I consider about one of the heights of Western culture. There are things that are so beautiful in it that it's just wondrous. But where it begins in a cave that's out in the wilds somewhere. And in the cave there's a huge forge, hearth with forge, and there are two anvils, a large anvil and a small anvil. And the whole idea of caves, again going back to Plato, it's the whole idea of us being in our blind materialism. And we're at the far reaches from the center of spiritual being, as far as we're going to be in our evolution, and that's about the way things are. As the activity begins, an old friend is here, Mima, if you remember Mima from the first opera. He is the dwarf that made the Tarnhelm and a lot of other devices for Albrecht. Albrecht, after once forging the ring for himself, didn't have to do any work anymore. He just took over and let other people do the work. That's often the way it goes. It's the way to rise in evolution. And this is a whole evolutionary principle. If it is a top-down as well as a bottom-up evolution that we belong to, if we began as a conception in spirit and gradually descended into matter, becoming more and more individualized and in a way more and more ignorant, then when we return, we have to go through the same stuff that we came out by. In short, we see it two ways. We see it one way involving, where we are creatures, and we see it one way evolving, where we are creators. And all of the things that we did along the way as we were creatures, we have to meet on the way back. And that's just the way it is. It's a closed system. If you swim from the, you know, if you die from the top, from the surface down to the bottom and come back up, you've got to go past the same things that you went on the way down. So it's not surprising that Mima would come back. That things are on the upswing now. We're going to be redeemed and taken out of matter where the law has been broken and Wotan has been weakened. It's become sort of a no man's land. Mima hasn't changed. He's complaining as he was before. Only instead of complaining about having to work for Albrecht, he complains about having to work for Siegfried, who harasses him and constantly wants more of him. Not because he's a cruel and mean slave driver, but just because he doesn't know any better. And as he is complaining, he's doing his other favorite thing. He's scheming in the same way that he schemed that he was going to make the Tarnhelm and put it on, and then he would be free from Albrecht, and because he could be invisible to Albrecht. Now he's scheming that he's going to forge this sword that was broken by Siegfried's father fighting with Wotan, and he's going to get that sword put back together, and he's going to get the dragon's hoard, meaning all of the gold, meaning the ring and the helmet. See, that's everybody wants the same thing here. It's the same self-consciousness. Well, as he's in the cave scheming away, Siegfried comes in, and he's a boisterous young man, maybe 16 years old or something like that. And he brings a friend. He brings in a wild bear, and he sicks the wild bear on Mima, who becomes terrified. And Mima tries to speak with aged wisdom, because Mima is passing himself off as the father of Siegfried. And Mima says, "Why do you do things like this?" And Siegfried, being extremely boisterous, says, "All the better to torment you." And then he says, "How about a sword? Do you have a sword that I won't break?" Because what's happening is Mima, as you remember, is this great smith, but he keeps making swords, and Siegfried is so strong that he keeps shattering them. And he says, "Well, I've got a new sword here that I've just reforged from your last one. I think this is the one that's got the temper that's going to handle it all." And Siegfried picks up the sword and tries to cut through the anvil of all things with it, and the sword shatters. And he scolds Mima for cheap work, bad labor, third world labor. And Mima figures, "Well, I better placate him by giving him something to eat." And he gives him some roast meat and some broth. And Siegfried is not going to be placated quite so easily, and he just dashes it all to the ground, and he says, "I roasted my own meat fresh from the kill, and I don't want any slop." In short, the character of Siegfried, as he is defined, is primitive or primal and unrefined, no sophistication of any kind, but very self-reliant. And that is the perfect ground for a hero. There are no preconceptions. There's no self-babying. There are no tendencies that have been built in that this is the right way or the wrong way. All he has is himself and his interaction with the world, and perfect stock for a hero. And Mima starts complaining, and he says, "I get no gratitude for everything that I've done in bringing you up. I get no gratitude." Now, if we look at Siegfried and Mima as the higher and lower selves, and if we look at Siegfried as the true hero, then being spiritual self that comes into power throughout the entire domain of creation, Mima as lower self is what we have to deal with, because we so often focus in the lower self and we identify ourselves through that. And what do? We're always self-pitying. You know, we feel sorry for ourselves, and we, you know, we pamper ourselves. All of those things are egoism, you know, that we think, oh, we're so fragile. Whereas if we realized the true power of spirit, we wouldn't ever baby ourselves about anything. In fact, most of the initiates in history have not at all been pampered and spoiled people. They've been very rough and ready types of people. Siegfried says, "Oh, I have a lot of gratitude for you. I've learned a lot from you. But there's one thing that I haven't learned at all yet, and that is how to live with someone like you who I loathe. I can't stand you at all, and I have to learn how to live with that. You haven't taught me that yet." Now, that's exactly the state where I think every true spiritual hero is at. As long as we're happy with ourselves, as long as we compromise with ourselves, we're stuck in this materialistic consciousness. It's only when we say, "I can't stand being this way. I hate being sickly and weak. I hate the parts of me that are selfish. You know what I'm trying to say? That there's going to be this whole idea of too much self-acceptance and all of this whole New Agey kind of philosophy where you're taught, oh, you have to love yourself. If you know your divine nature, there's no question about that. But what I see all of these people that are so involved with these, oh, you've got to love yourself movements, all they do is pamper their own weaknesses. And, you know, that's... this is exactly the state where one becomes a hero, is when they can't stand being the way they are and they do something about him. Mima says, this is always the way it is with fledglings. Later on, when he grows up into his true nature, he'll love him after a while. He'll love Mima. And that's the standard line too, you know, like after a while you learn to love me, just, you know, after you have settled for living in your lower nature and after you've settled for a meager kind of personality, you learn to love it, as people do who compromise. Siegfried counters, and he comes up with all kinds of nature analogies. And he says the foxes love their parents and the fledglings love their parents and they're like them. You see, Siegfried, the first things that we begin with our spiritual insights are not with the inner worlds. In a way, we who have come to spirituality through what might be called literary occultism, we've been in a way peremptorily introduced to the spiritual life, because we're told so much beforehand and we don't get it by experience and we don't get it directly from nature. But when we do start getting it directly from nature and we don't need it second or third hand, and we don't need it pre-cooked and digested for us, then we're ready to grow spiritually. Mima is not a completely weak adversary, and he says, Siegfried, you're not a bird or you're not a fox. You know, he says, you're a human, and it's different with humans. And that's true. It's very true that that's the way things go. But Siegfried then says, while I was out hunting today, I looked in a pool and I saw my image, and it doesn't look like Mima. I'm already much, much bigger than you. You're an ugly little dwarf. And what gives? And it's true, our outer nature isn't what we really are. And we realize that in our inmost, in our best self, we're not as bad as we seem to come off. Mima, when he has no real logical retort, when he knows that he's been caught, he says, he resorts to the things that everybody does who's losing an argument. He starts name-calling. He says, Siegfried, you're idiotic. Don't be such a big baby about all of this. Just face it that this is the way things are in the world. And that's the way our lower nature is. It tells us we're stupid and foolish for pursuing a way that doesn't get us any bucks or it doesn't get us any sensual pleasures or anything like that. It says, you're stupid. You're an idiot for following this kind of life. And that piques Siegfried to the max, and Siegfried grabs him by the neck and he says, I demand knowledge about my parents. And that's what we have to do. We have to take control of the lower nature. So far yet, I haven't been able to grab it by the neck. You know, it always seems to slink away from me, or I seem to let go of it, but somehow we have to control every thought, every desire, and cut it off from its source of usurpation, where it draws its strength. when he's caught, Mima tells the truth, because that's the way the lower nature is. The lower nature is filled with truth. It just tends to use it in devious and non-productive ways. But our personality built into us is everything that is in the cosmos. And so when Siegfried grabs him by the neck, Mima tells him, well, I found this woman in pain in the woods, and she had this shattered sword blade, and she was pregnant, and she was just about to deliver a child. And Mima helps her deliver the child, and she dies in the childbirth. But before she dies, she says she wants her child to be named Siegfried. So Siegfried is his name. Now, this is a very important theme. This is one of those things that one doesn't often see. Siegfried is the son of a widow, meaning to say he's a Freemason. The invisible father has impregnated the mother who gives birth to the visible, who is to redeem the truth that is lost in the father pouring itself into the imagination, into the feminine mother. This is a theme that comes about again and again, that the inward, which needs expression, is redeemed in giving birth through the mother into the visible. But the visible redeems the truth by finding its true nature in the invisible. This is the cycle. This is the whole of evolution is repeated again and again. It's like saying that the two need each other. The invisible needs the visible to become manifest and gain new knowledge, but the visible needs to come to understand the inner meaning behind things and to be reborn in that. So Siegfried is a Freemason, because all Freemasons claim their ancestry goes back to Eve, but not Eve and Adam, but Eve and the Lucifer spirit Semael. The Dead Sea Scrolls have now proved that there are and there were two ancient views of the origin of the children of Eve. And it states very clearly that by some type of demonic being, Eve brought Cain into being. We all know the story of the Lucifers, who brought divine knowledge into our scheme of things. It's a lovely myth. It's a myth of falling. But it's a myth of falling into the kind of freedom that is now available to us. So he's a worldly orphan. At the same time, he has no father and he has no mother. And that's the state where all of us are. This is exactly what Christ is alluding to when he's saying he who would be my follower would have no father and mother, meaning to say that we start out fresh. Everyone stands on one's own, and one must separate oneself from all of the things of parentage, all the things of nation, all the things of race and custom. In general, one must separate oneself from the psychic background, from all of society. One must stand alone. So in a way, Christ's statement is exactly the same thing as in the myths when the hero is exposed in the wilderness. We have to become complete individuals and completely self-reliant if we are going to be gods. And if we're going to be true individual selves, we have to know that without any influence, without any connection from anything else. So he delivers, Mima tells the whole story of how he brought up Siegfried, and he sings the story with all kinds of self-praise, and he makes himself a hero rather than just an innocent bystander. Siegfried then demands, what is my mother's name? And he gets it. It is Sieglinde. This is the point. We want to know the names which is to know the powers of where we have come from spiritually. That's where he's at. And then Siegfried says, I want proof, because you've told me all of these lies and now you're telling me a totally different story. Something has to be untrue. I want proof. And the proof is that Mima presents him with the two pieces of the sword. The divided creative energy, Siegmund couldn't make it as a hero. He had all the valiance of a hero, but he was divided between the higher spiritual life and the lust for Sieglinde. And he separated himself from the law by defiance, not by overcoming it. So the divided power, it's sort of like when we become unified, or when we're on the verge of becoming one, we have to confront ourselves with our divided state. If you're going to be a hero, let's live like one. Supposedly the words are that come from the teacher within when one is being initiated and is having to confront all of one's evil and all of one's self-divisions is, if thou be Christ, help thyself. And that's Siegfried is immediately confronted with that. But Siegfried still is in the more transcendental type of consciousness, and his self-reliance hasn't been carried out completely in the material world. And that's the way it is, that if we awake to the truths of things through the mind, even the lower mind, we have understandings, and those understandings have to be carried out. And you know, it's easy to think, have a thought and to think about those things and to say, well, I'm going to be the pristine manager of all of this, carry this out. And eventually that will be that way, but first you have to bring your authority all the way through. But Siegfried doesn't know that yet. And he says to Mima, fix the sword so I can go out in the world. Because you told me you'd let me go out into the world when I have a sword that I can rely on, and then you produce all of these terrible swords for me, and now you tell me here is this sword that'll never fail. Get it for me, because you know I don't want to be in the cave forever. When once you realize that there's a bigger world out there, he wants to be in it. And he dashes out of the cave, leaving Mima in his perpetual state of dejection. And now the dejection is based on something else, in that he realizes that no Nibelung can forge the sword. Only Velsung can forge the sword. That is to say, the lower nature cannot control what is divine. Much as it would like to in its schemes to get it for its own self, it can't do it. There are two different kinds of consciousness. The consciousness that Mima has is more like the Atlantean consciousness, and the consciousness of Siegfried is more like our consciousness, even though right now we seem to be very immersed in matter. And it's a really deceptive thing. You hear a lot of people who don't do a lot of thinking. They think that the Atlanteans had all of this scientific knowledge and they produced all of these wonders and such like that. And it isn't quite true, because the consciousness of the Atlanteans was much different than our consciousness. They didn't have doubt. They didn't have the perception of the external world. They didn't think in the analytical way that we thought. They were more magical in their thought, and it was less concrete, and it was less controlled. They did produce some phenomena, and they did produce some devices out of their magical talent. But this is one of the things that often happens to us. One of the problems of the ego is that when we, or even of self, when we recognize our selfhood and we recognize that it is an eternal thing, and we have this consciousness of self that seems to run forever, we fall into an illusion of thinking that it's always been the way it is now. And that's just not the case. And so we have all of these superstitions about what Atlantis was all about. Well, as Mima is dejected and has to try to fix this sword, another old character comes back, but he comes back in a totally different form. He comes with a walking stick and a big brimmed hat. It's Wotan as the Wanderer, because Mercury is the swiftest of all the planets and it wanders more than all of the others. It is the planet that rules the initiations. It's the planet of mind. Let's see if I can find something here. The Wanderer says, "Much have I explored, much perceived. Matters of great weight and moment have I been able to impart to many, prevent for many that which they feared, gnawing tribulation of the heart." So he describes himself in such a way. And if this brings in, I don't know how to say that. This brings in a cosmic element to the drama, because previously the gods and the humans understood each other and they saw each other quite readily. But now things have sunk down into this great state of materialism so that the gods are even enfeebled in their ability to completely control things. And humans have run amok in their sinful ways and in their enterprising ways, so that as the gods appear, they have to appear in a more indirect, a more symbolic form. They're not right in the midst of things. They're not seen as the gods, and they function more indirectly because humans have taken over their own power when the sword was shattered. They defied the law. So Mima, at this point in his dejection, wants to be left alone, and he says, "You loiterer ought to leave." But Wotan persists, and Mima persists that he should leave. But finally, when Wotan suggests one of the oldest things in all mythology, he suggests the riddle game. He says, "I will give you three riddles, and if you can give me three riddles, and if I don't answer all three of them right, you can have my head." And this is an old question and answer game. It always involves three riddles. I suppose you've recognized by now, have you ever read The Lord of the Rings by Tolkien? That the whole Lord of the Rings, the whole idea of the ring is selfishness, and many of the elements of the Lord of the Rings was just expropriated wholesale from this myth, from the Wagnerian telling of it. But the whole idea of being able to answer three fundamental questions of life, usually they are, what am I, where have I been, where am I going? The three big why questions of the mysteries. First, you have to know what you are, and then you have to know what you are as a consequence of what you have done in the past, and what is coming out of that to become something in the future. This kind of thing, where one talks usually to the god, is called a hermetic dialogue. And it is usually present at all initiations and at all spiritual unfoldments. Usually it is the Hierophant taking the place of the god Mercury, asks the questions, and it's not just usually a mental game to be able to answer these questions. It is the answering of them is evidence of your true knowledge of existence, your true knowledge of the cosmos, because it's sort of like a catechism that in order to be initiated into the spiritual worlds, you have to understand and you have to prove that you know the very elementary things about them, else it would be too dangerous, or you actually have no right to walk in the kingdom of the gods if you don't know what the kingdom of gods is all about. So the questions that in this, they're very simple-minded questions in the opera, Wotan asks about the different spiritual worlds. He says, who are the inhabitants of the earth, the bowels of the earth? And these are the questions that Albrecht is asking first of Wotan. And Wotan says, the Nibelungs once ruled by Black Albrecht, the Lord of the Ring. So he knows who's down in the heart of the earth. So Mima asks about the next realm, the realm that they are at right now. Who inhabits the surface of the earth? And Wotan answers the Rieselungs, who are descendants of the race of the giants. He tells about Fafnir and Fasalt and the dead giant. And then he finally, Mima asks about the spiritual realms, and he says, who inhabits the cloudy heights of the spiritual worlds? And Wotan, as disguised as the Wanderer, says, the gods. Wotan, who wields the world ash spear, is the lord of both the Nibelungen and the Rieselungen. And so he is, and Mima says, all right, you answered all the questions, now scram. And he doesn't realize that once you've entered into this kind of agreement, there's reciprocity. You can't ask something of the gods without the gods asking something of you. That's the big thing for us in the spiritual life. We'd like to know what's what. And so we ask for spiritual powers, or we ask to come to some kind of spiritual experience, but we never realize that when we do, so much more is going to be asked of us in turn. And Wotan said, but you haven't received me hospitably. Now, on the price of your head, you have to answer my three questions. And, of course, this is going to be a very difficult thing for the lower nature, because the lower nature, especially the unredeemed lower nature, as Mima represents, hasn't been unified yet. The sword hasn't been welded back together. So Wotan asks, what is the race of the earth that is most severely treated yet most loved, beloved of Wotan? And Mima says, oh, I know that one. That's the Volsungs. And the last of the Volsungs is Siegfried. That's the whole idea of whom the Lord loveth, the Lord chasteneth. And so the next question is a very leading question, because Wotan is not asking these questions just for information. He's trying to plant seeds, and he's trying to make sure that things come about. And this is done like almost like great auguries or great prophecies. See, the prophecies seem so otherworldly when they really hinge on very down-to-earth events. And so the next question is, by what sword must the boy Siegfried overcome Fafnir to get the ring and the gold? And Mima certainly knows that. And he says, it's Nothung, the sword that was shattered by Sigmund. And then the last question comes. And he doesn't know the answer, obviously. And the question comes to him, who will wield the sword? Who will wield it, and who will weld it? Who will fuse it back together and make it one? And Mima says, I am the wisest of all smiths, going all the way back to the Nibelungs, and I can't do it. I can't even scratch the thing. If I can't do it, I don't know who can. And by that, he admits his limitations. And Wotan says, he isn't smarty pants about it, he's just very straightforward. And he says, you lose, I claim your head at the proper moment. And that's the way it is, because the lower nature has to die as the lower nature, because it's identified with the limited. It's identified, you know, it's only a temporary thing to gain knowledge, which is eventually to become part of the spiritual power. Yes?
Any significance that it's the head?
Yes, because the head is the sphere that is like the spirit and is eventually going to be removed from the body, which is delineated, which is the pole that is divided between the spiritual and the material. In one sense, the head is dying, but in another sense, the head represents the spirit more than anything else, being a sphere. But Wotan does give him the answer, because he has to prove that he knows the answer himself, and he says, the sword can only be fused back together by someone who has never known fear. And with that, Wotan leaves, and Mima now is panicked for his life, and he feels that he's going to lose it to Fafnir or something like that. And he hears a noise, and he hides behind the anvil, and it is Siegfried who comes back, and he says, all right, you lazy lout, where's my new sword? He chides Mima, and Mima is talking to himself, Saro Vosi, and he's saying to himself, never learning fear. And Siegfried keeps saying, where's my sword, and chastening him and such like that. And the second time that Mima says under his breath, never learned fear, he's still trying to solve or figure out what's going on. Siegfried asks him, what kind of nonsense is this that you're talking about, never learning fear? And Mima, then it dawns on him that this is the one who has never learned fear. And it's really interesting what transpires at this point, clearly because Siegfried represents the spirit which has never known isolation or has never known separation, and it really hasn't come into full awareness of its indirect selfish acts through the lower nature. It doesn't know any fear because it knows immortality. It knows it's divine. And that's the way it is. So Siegfried says, starts telling him and tells him about the sword and tells him that only someone who doesn't know fear can put this sword together. And Siegfried says, what's fear? And then Mima describes fears. And he describes it with horrible inadequacy. He describes what it's like inside when you feel fear. And the really interesting thing is that what he's describing is his own limited nature to a T. He's describing what his life is, what his life is like. And it's actually the way we describe our lives. We're afraid of losing our jobs, we're afraid of getting sick, we're afraid of not being appreciated, we're afraid of not being loved. And we have all of these eerie feelings inside that something terribly bad is going to come to us. It's a projection of our own guilt, and it's a projection of our own ignorance and our own isolation. And it's really beautiful the way that it's so accurately described, It's a little bit long, so I won't read it. And sometimes that kind of reading gets a little bit boring. And so we'll pass on. After this takes place, you know, Siegfried chides Mima about his inadequate description, because from that Siegfried certainly didn't learn any fear at all. And Mima says, his scheming now comes to fruit. He says, I will take you to someone who will teach you fear. His name is Fafnir, and he lives in the cave east of the Valkyries Mountain. Here that whole idea of east comes up again, the idea of Lucifer and of all of the past. All of our past is in an eastward direction. When we flowed with downstream, remember when we talked about Isis, Osiris, and Horus last year? We said that the river Nile, when you go one direction, when you go downstream, you become human, and when you go upstream, you become divine. Well, to go downstream is to go east, because that is the involutionary stream of things when we are led about and oh so dutifully and all oh so passively, we flow into matter. In fact, the people who evolve the most, or the beings that evolve the most, are the ones that are the most supple and the most lending themselves to the ways of the gods who are forming us and making us become things. That's the old way, and that has resulted in the selfishness that is luciferic. Remember the culmination that brought us deeply into matter, ignorance, isolation, sin, and hopefully freedom, were the Lucifers, who were represented again by Cain, who lived east of Eden, or the place where the goddess of truth, Brunhilde, lies asleep behind the fire. And so Siegfried says, Mima tells him that he will need the sword that only one who doesn't know fear can fix. And Siegfried says, Mima says, I can't do it. I've tried it again and again, and I can't even get filings off of it. And Siegfried says the really big words that are really important for us in the spiritual life. He says, I will do it myself. The ultimate of self-reliance, the impossible, the wielding of divided humanity, can only take place when we say, in innocent, godlike strength, I'm going to do it myself. I'm not going to rely on anybody else to do it. And what transpires then is a very, very beautiful, beautiful thing. Siegfried blows up the fire in the forge, and this is the way he says it. He starts filing when Mima for years has been trying to get one single filing and he's never been able to do it. And Siegfried immediately starts filing the whole thing into little pieces. And he said, I must see it reduced to splinters. What is broken into pieces, thus do I subdue. This is none other than that very paradoxical thing. The thing where Christ says, I bring not peace but a sword, because the whole principle, that's one of the most warlike statements from Christ, and that goes back to the myth of Dionysus Zagreus that we talked about last year when we were talking about the principle of distribution. The only way each of us can be redeemed as singular entities, as God with a small g, as microcosm of God with a large g, is if each one is reduced to its singular state. And the same thing is true. That's one way of looking at distribution. Another way we looked at distribution is we saw that the simple unified truth, which is at one in the spiritual realms, when it becomes differentiated or distributed in the phenomenal realms, the more deeply it is expressed in the phenomenal realms, the more separate it is. So that each little event in nature or each little thing that happens has a thousand different interpretations. But each one of those, like eternity, must be broken into or seen in terms of specific little moments. Each moment is a turning point. Each little event that we have to overcome is the way we establish our identity. Each little separate state, as we confront it, we absorb it into ourselves and we return or we spread out that unity over everything that has been distributed. So we have to be able, in order to live in the giant moment, the now of the entire cosmos, we have to be able to break down each experience, or we have to be able to concentrate our spiritual being into each moment so that nothing is lost in each moment. That's the only thing that really separates the life of a spiritual student from anybody else. The events are all the same. We all have the same kinds of illnesses and the same kinds of fears and things like that. The only difference is that the spiritual student lives in each little point of time more fully and gets much more out of it and reunifies it by giving itself to it. So the whole process of distribution has to be carried out to its ultimate in order for the hero to be born, and in order, everything has to be divided all to the single atomic level where it is indubitable, where it is a one state of oneness, and then it can be redeemed, because in that simplest indubitable way we must not, we cannot doubt what we are and what we know. This is sort of like Cartesian, where you get down to one thing: I think, therefore I am, therefore I think I am, where we know nothing but ourself and see ourself in every experience. What happens then, as Mima is watching this, he's in awe at what Siegfried can do, where he failed, and he failed miserably. Here Siegfried is, it's child's play to him to reduce the sword to filings. And that's really the way it is when we think about what our lives are. When we are manifesting the spirit, or when the spirit is manifesting itself in our personality, we're astounded, we're awed. We don't even believe it's us. We think it's something of God or something like that. It is. But we think it's something completely foreign to us, rather than realizing that it's our real nature, and that our real nature really is powerful like that, and we don't have to do all the defensive little things we tend to do. So Siegfried finally bellows the fire, and he melts the steel, and he pours the sword afresh, and He sticks it in the water. And there's a huge hissing and all like that. This is literally what it is. This is the way we have to go about things. We have to fuse things. When we recognize each element indubitably in its separate way, then we have to, in fact, burn them up by the power of our will and unite them like into one thing, into a molten sea. And everything has to be broken down in that way. This is really all of our experiences here, like when we take the events of daily life, what they really mean. If we look at all the trivial details, we begin to get an understanding, but it isn't until we digest them or until we fuse them into something more simple that we get the idea that was behind. As far as the tempering is concerned, the spinal fire is twofold. It's the mystical spinal fire, and it is the occult spinal fire. The mystical going the visceral path and passing through the heart, first on its way to the head, and the other passing straight up the spine and through the voice box. And the two paths have to be fused together, fire and water, feeling and thought, the spiritual masculine and the spiritual feminine, the two poles, the receptivity, the imagination, and the will have to be brought together. They have to be one. And so this is sort of a recollection. Remember that all of this started in the Rhine River when we swam in the fog. And fog is a result of fire and water blended together. You know, everything is steamed. The heat, which represents the power and the agency of love sacrificed by the spirit, it meets the coldness of space as water and steam comes out of it. And what is being relived here is this is a return to the Atlantean state when we were much more simplified and much more unified, just like the Rhine maidens swimming in the water. And then we got into the separate differentiation. And in the refusing of the sword is a going back in one way to the way we were. But we go back in choosing to be unified, in choosing to be simplified with the knowledge that we have gained in being divided human beings and in being sinful human beings and fighting against it all and being in the dark of matter and in the woods and you know, all of that kind of darkness. Now, at the same time that Siegfried is re-pouring the sword and is acting as the smith himself, Apollo Smitheus, the original smith was Apollo. That's where the name comes from. Mima is busy at the same time because he's hatching this plot that it's working out just right for him because Siegfried is going to fight with the dragon. It'll probably be at least mutual destruction, and he's going to end up with all the gold. That's the way it is. The lower nature always schemes and thinks it's going to get the divine for itself, and it's going to have all the power for itself, not realizing that that's not possible, because with that small, closed-minded beginning and end consciousness, you can never have the spirit for yourself. It just doesn't go that way. So what Mima is doing is at the same time that he's pouring the sword, he's decocting a poison. And if the dragon doesn't get Siegfried, the poison will. And in a way, it's been described that the panacea, that flow of fire or energy that is represented by the sword in the story we're telling, it's one of the most beautiful quotes you'd ever want to see. It's from the novel Zanoni, that to he who is not prepared, the elixir is the deadliest of poisons. That is to say that the creative energy that is represented by the sexuality, that is the spinal fire that allows us to reclaim our divinity, to kindle the flame of godhood in ourselves by becoming creative beings, if we're not ready, that's a deadly poison. And it's like saying the lower nature recognizes a big moment is coming. We're talking about redemption of the entire cosmos through a hero. Because it's not just for ourselves that we're doing this. We're doing this for the whole business. And so a big moment is a brew, and in that big moment, the lower nature puts together all the worst that it has to offer. And as Siegfried is hammering away now, he's got the sword forged, and he is now hammering on it and giving it all of its temper. How does he say it here? Forge me a sturdy sword, hammer, ho-ho, ho-hi, Ho, 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 hi, how the gay sparks gladden my heart. Anger's force lends luster to the valiant one. Merrily you laugh at me, though you be unwilling and cross. Hi, ha, 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 hi, ha, ha. And he's recognizing really clearly, he enjoys doing what he's doing. Like every true hero, it's never drudgery. It's just the opposite of Mima, who is always complaining, who's in the lower nature that can't see anything but his own egoistic self. What happens with Siegfried is, in the spirit, he's always enjoying what he's doing and all of the tasks that Mima thought were really difficult. All of the sparks represent the creative activities that come along the way. It never happens but that we raise the spinal fire, but that the sparks are flying. It's like fireworks, the insights that come to us, and little by little we begin to understand that there is a whole network or a whole world of light of which we now only see sparks. It's also very interesting to note that the basic anger that what normally we used to try to destroy people, when that gets put into the fusing activity, that's the only thing that can really beat things into shape. The anger is none other than the way of channeling the healing energy. So the at the same time that Siegfried is finishing his work and enjoying his work and appreciating his work as every true creator does, Mima is also reveling, but he's sort of gloating. And instead of thinking about what he's doing and enjoying it, he's living in that world of dreams where, oh, all this glory that I'm going to have, I'm going to rule as Albrecht used to rule, and I'm going to have it all like that. You might say that before the true healing of our personality can take place, that pimple of egoism has to come to a full head and be burst. And that's where Mima is at this point. And Siegfried at this point, mind you now, this is all sung with anvil strikes and all like that. It's a really beautiful thing to hear. But Siegfried takes the blade and fits it into the hilt. And he picks it up and he cuts right through the anvil in one blow. And that's if the physical body is our anvil, if it receives our blows, and if it is the vehicle through which we develop the temper that we beat things into us, each hammer blow being a destiny experience that wakes us up a little more and brings out the divine willpower in us, it only stands to reason then that the ability to leave the physical body that comes with the drawing of the sword should in fact be like splitting a seed pod. So at the end of Act 1, we have someone now who has undivided attention. And it's a pure, simple attention that doesn't understand fully what's all at stake yet. It hasn't really been put through the full trial. It knows no fear, but it has rejuvenated the spinal fire. It has rejuvenated the sword so that the sword is now ready to go. We'll go a little way into Act 2 and maybe do Act 2. We certainly won't get into Act 3 this time. We'll have to do that next time, because Act 3 is the height of art, I think, in the Western world. This is not only a battle, this is not only a great moment that is about to take place, but it takes place exactly, or the introduction to it takes place exactly as we would expect it. It always is the darkest before the dawn, and so Act 2 begins right outside of it's the dark of night, and it's in a forest, and the forest runs right up to the edge of Fafner's cave. And at Fafner's cave, who should be waiting but Albrecht? Because, you know, at a great moment, and any moment can really be a great moment if we can live in it in the now, everything, the eternal, is in every moment. And therefore, everything created by the eternal is going to be there. And in a great moment, you expect all the big players to be there. And that's exactly the way it is. It opens up, it's very dark, and Albrecht is there in the dark, sort of singing to himself. And off in the woods, you see a light now and then as it goes between the trees. And who should appear but the wanderer? Both the forces, the adversaries of the just law, which is limited, and the unjust source of sin, Albrecht, sort of the luciferic creature that stole the fire or of the gold and took it down into the underworld, they both appear. They know that there's big stuff at hand. And they recognize each other. They recognize each other as adversaries, and they talk to each other with all kinds of sarcasm. It's really harsh. And they bicker. And they bicker about theft and who stole what. And, you know, that's, you know, this is a polarity on a higher level. And the poles at the extremes of the high and the low, you expect them to be opposite of each other. And so that's what's happening here. This is another reason why things are similar for all heroes, because we've all gone through the same events, and when it comes down to it, inwardly we're all built the same, and therefore the same players are at stake when something is about to happen. Let's see here, something I'd like to read. Oh, yes. Albrecht says something to the effect that Wanderer or Wotan, you're going to get the gold back, and I suppose you think you've got a rigged game here, and that you're going to, as in the past, you're going to try and help the hero out. And Wotan knows better now, and here's what he says. I am leaving to fend for himself. Whether he stands or falls, he is his own master. Only heroes can avail me aught. Meaning to say, in the moment, even though we may have been helped by Hierophants, even though the gods have made us everything that we are, in the moment when we're ready to take over, when we're ready to meet the dragon, which is the manifestation of all of our past evil deeds unredeemed, when we're ready for that great moment, when we say we want to be gods, we're left on our own. We may be beloved of the gods, but at that time, we have to stand on our own. We only can do it. The irony of it is that we only can do it by drawing on the divine within ourselves, but we must do that, and we must do that alone. At this point, Wotan, even though he has said that he's not going to rig the game, what he does is he prophesies. Now, he prophesies that there's going to be a victory, even though he's not going to interfere. And this is a really lovely way of doing it. Remember I said earlier that the gods and the humans at this point don't see each other anymore the way they did back in the times of the Rhine Maidens. And the gods, with their wisdom and their understanding, they proclaim it in a much different way. And it sounds like a prophecy. And though it has been lived out in the cosmic formula as a prophecy, it has not been brought into history yet as a destiny. So something can be prophesied, but that still doesn't mean that it's true until it has been actualized. And so the actualization is what is at stake. That's why only the actualizers can redeem the world. Because each of us, as we in our part, bring to bear the divine on all of the creative deeds that we have done, most of which have been evil, and we've created dragons, only at that point can we redeem that much of the cosmos. It affects everybody else if we redeem it, if we become initiates, but when we do that, we're doing it for the whole world, and they're affected by it, but we have to do it on our own. In the prophecy, which is a big booming sort of thing, Wotan awakens the dragon, and he tells him, "Lagad, it's coming." And that's the way it is. It's, you know, remember the book of Job? The book of Job is literally a book of initiation. And literally in the opening chapters of that book, God gives permission to the devil to do all of the tempting and to bring all of the scourges to Job. And in this case, the divine Wotan, who acts as Hierophant, is waking up, or sort of pre-waking up, the evil for Siegfried to deal with. Albrecht tries to warn Fafnir, and he taunts him a little bit, but Fafnir goes back to sleep. And that is exactly what our nature is here. We are asleep. We came here desiring immortality for ourselves. We came here desiring passion. But the consequence of consuming ourselves in all of this passion and selfishness is that we go to sleep in phlegmatism. If we baby ourselves the way Mima would have us baby ourselves, we go to sleep. And we don't realize our perilous condition. And if the dragon represents the dweller on the threshold, and it represents all of the unredeemed evil, it represents something that is in a latent sleeping state. It's a power in ourselves that can be something really wonderful. It can be the deepest creative wisdom of all. It happens to be a very menacing thing because the way we created it was in a dark way. Oh, let's take a look. There's something else here to read in. Yes.
Phlegmatism is phlegmatic?
Yes. Phlegmatism is when you're only too happy to rest in your accomplishments. As the wanderer is leaving, he says, "Well, Albrecht, that stroke failed, but call me rogue no more. I counsel you, heed this advice well now. Everything goes after its own fashion. You will change nothing in it. I leave you the place free. Be assured, fight it out with your brother Mime, or Mima, whose kind, no doubt, you can expect better." So this is another kind of prophecy. Wotan is stating that things are going to go their course. When a cause has been set into motion, it must have certain effects, and there's nothing that you can get away from. things are going to go their way, and you can try to change them, but it's not going to happen that way. You can try as much as you like. Wotan leaves, and Albrecht hides, and a storm comes up, and as the storm subsides, Mima and Siegfried arrive. Now, Mima doesn't want this to be over before the dragon is killed. He doesn't want to kill Siegfried until the dragon has been done in. So he starts warning Siegfried about the look out for the poisonous spittle. That in itself will kill you, and the tail will strike you from behind. Remember, this sounds exactly like the Hydra. Remember the snake-like creature that Heracles fought with? It had totally poisonous spittle to it. The flow of the energy in it was completely poisonous, and it could strike you from behind with its tail. And that is, look out for the recoil. Only when you have the unified consciousness that sees both ways are you wary so that nothing is going to strike you from behind. You see what I'm trying to say? If you have the panoramic view of spiritual vision, that you have what people say you have eyes in the back of your head. You can see in all directions at the same time. We have a really limited consciousness now. I like to get up north sometimes in the fire towers. You get up in the fire tower and you get up there and you can get on top and you can turn very quickly and you get, in effect, the panorama effect. You know what I'm trying to say? Where you can see all dimensions and all directions at the same time. Siegfried then asks Mima one question. He says, does it have a heart? And that's a really insightful question. Siegfried is not concerned about how bad its spittle is and how big it is and how big its tail is. What he wants to know right away is he wants to get at the heart of the matter. He wants to get it in its most vulnerable place. He wants to go to the place that he can do it in for certain. Mima is cowering at this point, both at the thought of the dragon and the shocking insight that Siegfried knows to ask for the heart right away. And he starts his old routine. It's, I've loved you so much. He starts buttering him up with love again. And Mima says, when the sun is at its zenith, then look out for Fafnir. When the sun is at its zenith, that's when things are at their material height. That's the visible sun. That's like saying that that's when the things are the most physical. When the sun is at its lowest, at midnight, is when we can do our greatest spiritual work. Because that is when we are withdrawn from the clutter, from all of the distractions of the external world and from all the needs and duties of the external world, and we can turn inward and unify. And that is literally, that's not only in that way, it's only when the sun is visible that we are in this material world. I don't know how to say it any other way. In the spiritual world, there is a light that comes from everywhere at the same time. And the sun, as the one object of direct light that casts shadows and such like that, it isn't like that in the spiritual worlds. The sun is everywhere, but only when we're in the material state, that is to say, when we are in the height of materiality at the turnover point between involution into matter and evolution from matter, that's the only time we can externalize and objectify our deeds as objects, as the dragon, And only at that time can we confront them and start to do the big turnaround so that we can go back into the source of light that doesn't die or that is from every place at the same time. At this point, Siegfried gets impatient with this same old coddling by Mima, and he chases him off into the forest. And the sun is rising, and Siegfried sits underneath the linden tree. This is a second tree that we run into. The first tree we ran into was the Yggdrasil tree, which was the world ash. Now, in the Norse mythology, the linden tree was the queen of the forest. We sometimes call them basswood around here. In the same way that the ash tree was associated with the king, the linden was the queen of the forest. It was very, very feminine. In fact, in nature, you find linden trees often growing on the banks of streams because they like to be near the water. You get along near a big river, you'll find both lindens and willows, both of which are very feminine. There's sort of a pun in here because in terms of the tree lore, the linden tree was used as a vermifuge, meaning that it was used to drive out worms. And it was claimed to be one of the only trees that never had worms in it, because in its underbark, it had something that drove worms away and they couldn't stand to be there. And the name of Fafnir as the dragon is called Worm. And there's sort of a hidden pun in all of this, if you're familiar with the tree lore. And the linden tree was also a tree that represented fertility, because it meant that there was water there, and water was where life comes from. You know, you see what we're coming to. We're coming to this feminine tree, the same thing that we had in Isis and Osiris last year when we talked about the mystery myth, that the tree that shelters and the tree that covers one in. And true to form, not having anything else on his mind, the mystery of his mother, Siegfried begins to ponder what his mother was like. And while he's lying under the tree, this stuff is really hard for me to talk on because it's potent for me. But while he's lying under the tree, a bird catches his attention. And it has a very unique song and it's sort of what it's like. When you first think about praying, it seems so stupid. Or when you first think about contemplating inside of yourself, it seems like, who'd want to do such a futile activity? Then gradually little murmurs start to happen within. In fact, this whole period is called, as he's lying under the linden tree, the music is called forest murmurs, because you hear all the little birds and animals and the music of the wind and the leaves and things like that. And that's what it's like turning inward. Gradually, an inward environment, it seems like you create it, but it actually waking up to it. And then you begin to recognize little voices. And in this case, it's a bird song. And so what he does is he cuts a piece of stick and he whittles it quickly, and he tries to make a whistle, you know, like a willow whistle where you skin the bark off and you cut notches in and make a little groove in and you slip the bark back on. You ever make a willow whistle? Oh, Boy Scouts are taught to do that sort of thing. It's a simple act. Willow whistles, they do that because they have that slick skin. I don't know if it's possible to linden. I don't know if I've ever tried that. And he can't, at this point, attune himself to the voice of nature. Remember when Heracles choked the serpents, and after that he could hear the sound, he could hear the words of all of the animals and knew what they meant. And we said that the serpents represented the not only the serpent fire, spinal serpent fire, but they represented the hierophants, who were the Tarian age initiators. But at any rate, after trying to imitate the bird with his whistle, because this is what real concentration is like. What is thinking other than attuning ourselves to the truth? When we are like Siegfried and we can ask those basic questions, who is my mother and father? Where did I come from? And eventually he's going to ask the question, where do I go to? And who am I? Those are questions yet to be found. When we once know that the truth is in us, and that we have the ability, with the truth being in us, to know the truth in anything else, then the whole process of concentration is a matter of attuning ourselves to whatever we want to know, because nothing can be kept from us if we attune ourselves to the truth of it. And so that's precisely the process that Siegfried is undergoing as he is sitting under the tree, and he gets frustrated because he can't do it, and he pulls out his horn and he blows the same kind of melody as the song of the bird, but he hasn't noticed that it's come to be noon. And when he sounds the horn, that's his calling card. He's saying, I have arrived. Here I am, world, I am ready to face things. Of course, the horn awakens Fafnir. And it's almost anticlimactic. They exchange nasty words, about each other. And that's the way we often look at it. We look at our evil as something we hate, and we struggle with it. And, it's not all just the sounding of our keynote. And they struggle. And very quickly in the struggle, Siegfried takes the sword and pierces through to the hilt, and he penetrates right to the heart and kills the beast. One shot. That's the way it has to be if the lower nature objectified collectively as the dweller is a dragon that is a result of an original sin. And the result of that original sin was selfishness, the forming of the ring of egohood. And we did that by selfish use of the sexual energy. Clearly then, there's only one stroke that can penetrate it. And it has to go to the heart, because the heart is where we most manifest our unselfishness. The heart, as we know from spiritual teachings, is the only organ that has both longitudinal and vertical stripes on the muscles, meaning to say it's a voluntary muscle. And the heart becomes more voluntary the more altruistic and the more unselfish we become. And therefore, to penetrate to the heart of evil, you can't get involved with, I'm going to kill this evil deed, and I'm going to kill that evil deed. You have to lead right away with the love that is completely unselfish. Now let's see here. I've got some other things I'd like to read. Oh, you want to hear the uh, This is the struggle. Fafner sings his swan song. You, who are you, bold youth, that has struck me through the heart? Who incited your boyish mettle to murderous deed? Your brain did not hatch the deed you perpetrated. Now here's what Siegfried says to that. A great deal I do not know, not yet even who I am. To join with you in mortal strife, you yourself stirred up my mettle. Now this is really true to the act of becoming hero, to becoming initiated. Because an initiate cannot but know that they are God. The first part of initiation is, first, we must face the darker part of our being. And we must assent to it, and we must overcome that. Or at least we must overcome it in essential. It may take a long time to completely redeem it. But we still don't know who we are. Because out of that, out of the dweller, we derive the soul power, we derive the fuel for the fire of the sword, so that we can have the enlightenment to come to know who we are. And it is only such an individual who is that honest in the being, only when we can say, when somebody says to you, how are you? Or only when somebody says, who are you? You can take the worldly sense and you can say, I'm Earl or I'm Wayne or something like that. But that is that's just a worldly limited view of ourself. It's just sort of a title that we've put on. But when we can honestly say, I don't know who I am. Who am I? What am I? Only at that point will we be able to be initiated and go much further. Fafner then sings his swan song about being the last of the giant giants, and he dies with the name Siegfried on his lips. And so Siegfried means the victor. It's very much like the Christians who want to perpetually say victory. It's sort of like saying that the death, the passing of an age, the passing of a time of self-seeking has only on its lips the word that it is being transferred to the future, to the victor, to the way things are going to be. At this point, Siegfried's still sort of a smarty pants young hero yet, and young men are not always too clean, and so he licks off his sword blade, and when he does, his consciousness is transformed, because the blood, or the essence of all of our evil deeds, if we once understand the principle of something, we understand it can be used for good or for evil. To be initiated is to be initiated into evil just as much as it is to be initiated into good. Because when we understand those principles, we could use them either way. And so the etheric flow, which is a flow of wisdom, he has drawn something out of the dragon now, and when he takes it into himself in spirit, he is a transformed man. Now suddenly, the bird starts singing again, and when the bird sings, it's different now. When the bird sings, he can hear what the bird is saying. In short, he's not only listening with the outside. By the act of love, in penetrating to the heart of matters and caring about that, he's gotten so he can hear the inner meaning and not just the outer tone of it. I'd like to see if I can find it here. Oh, yes. The bird says, "Hey, Siegfried, will henceforth own the Nibelung hoard. Oh, were he but to find the treasure in the cave now, if he should want to win the Tarnhelm, that would serve him for delectable deeds. But if he would desire to find the ring, it would make him ruler of the whole world." I'll read some of that again. Hey, Siegfried will henceforth own the Nibelungen hoard. Oh, were he but to find the treasure in the cave now. If he should want to win the Tarnhelm, that would serve him for delectable deeds. Do you notice the grammar? It's not direct, like when he's chiding Mima. It's not like even when Wotan is speaking. It's a very indirect grammatical sense. But if he were to desire to find the ring, it would make him ruler of the whole world. You see what I mean? It's in a logical, very indirect logical sense. You see, when you're in the transcendent consciousness, when you're in the realm of intuition, the ideas are formed in a much different way. They're whole and total. And it doesn't say, do this and you will get that. It goes more in the circular fashion of a whole idea and say, if this were to happen, this would happen. It's exactly the way, if you read Socrates, or Plato's Socrates anyway, where he's talking about the daemon. The daemon says always talks to Socrates. He says, it never tells me to do anything. It warns me of the consequences of some deeds, but it never tells me to do anything. Because that is where the creative power of the gods come from. This is another side of looking at the fact that Wotan can't directly enter in, because if he directly enters in, he's like the humans, and he's subject to that same kind of weakness that we as humans have. But when we have the transcendental consciousness, we have the whole consciousness, and we have to accomplish things through wholes and not through partial acts. We still do partial acts, but that is not the spiritual consciousness. So if the forest bird represents the intuition in ourselves, which is of a transcendental origin, it must perforce speak in that kind of tongue, because if it were to speak directly, that's just not the way it is in reality. So the beauty that Wagner has, even in the tensing of the way he phrases things, it's just immaculate. All right, I think I'm going to break at this point, and then next week we'll finish up the struggle at the cave mouth, and we get to one of the most beautiful things in the history of all art. Yeah, I'm sorry if I'm childish about it, but I get excited.